It's here and now. U.S. government scientists have concluded that North Korea is not only making nuclear materials for weapons, but has sold it to Libya, something some in the administration are calling an alarming piece of news. The story was leaked to New York Times White House correspondent David Sanger, who joins us now on the line. And David, remind us, what is new here? What did we know and what didn't we know prior to this leaked report?
Yeah, it's the right question, Robin, because, you know, with North Korea, everything comes in bits and pieces. Here's what we knew. We knew, of course, that they have developed a couple of weapons, or the CIA believes they have developed a few weapons, and that they did this from a program they've had going really since the 1960s and 70s using plutonium. And this is the program that President Clinton negotiated a freeze to in 1994. That freeze came off 2 years ago when the U.S. said, you know, you've cheated on this. We've discovered evidence that you started up a second program using uranium. What people have been looking for evidence of, though, is that in addition to developing weapons for itself, that North Korea was beginning to export any kind of nuclear material. They've long, to raise money, they've long exported missiles, but they've never messed with exporting nuclear material before. Once Libya agreed to disarm voluntarily, they turned over a huge amount of stuff to the U.S., including a form of uranium that they had in storage there. And there's been 9 months of very intensive testing on it to figure out where it came from. And the test has come out with about 90% or greater certainty that it's from North Korea.
Okay, let's stop you right there. Let's just tell us briefly about the process of that testing over the last 9 months. We understand that uranium has a sort of DNA, and so scientists used a process of elimination?
Yeah, I mean, what you'd love to be able to do in an ideal world is compare some uranium that you have in hand from uranium that you know comes from North Korea. Unfortunately, they don't have that.
To compare it to.
So instead, they compared it to all of the other known possible sources of uranium that could have ended up in Libya. They looked at uranium from Pakistan, from China, other places like that, and the signatures did not match up. So from a process of elimination, they've concluded that it came from North Korea. Now, the cask itself had some Korean markings on it. So, you know, at least at some point, the container had passed its way through North Korea.
Well, David Sanger, what is the significance of this, if true? As you write, the debate in the Bush administration has been whether to use diplomacy with North Korea or something tougher. What happens now?
Robin, we don't know what happens now, but this is a debate over how much time do you have. If you think North Korea is just developing its own nuclear weapons, well, then you have time to go negotiate a solution because they're not likely to use them. If you think, on the other hand, that they may have actually gone into the business of selling nuclear fuel, then you really don't know how much time you have. It could be that you have to shut the system down before they could sell to others.
Well, we've spoken to a defense analyst at Jane's, and you also quote outside experts who've said the Bush administration has overstated intelligence on North Korea in the past. And, of course, now it's a fact that faulty intelligence was behind the war in Iraq. So how much do you trust this report, especially leaks that seem to have come right before the State of Union address?
Well, this leak coming before the State of the Union address, we believe, is probably coincidental. It's a story we've been working on for many weeks. You always have to be suspicious of intelligence reports. In this particular case, you're dealing with a scientific analysis done out of the national laboratories, not done out of the CIA or elsewhere. So on the question of the origins of this material from Libya, probably pretty reliable. There's obviously room for error. The big question is, have they sold it elsewhere? And there's no evidence of that yet.
Well, David Sanger, as you point out, President Bush labeled North Korea a third of the axis of evil in his State of the Union speech 3 years ago. What is he expected to say this year, especially in light of this report?
He'll probably say nothing about the report. But in the State of the Union, I think people are going to be looking to see if he tries to invite North Korea to get back into these six-nation talks that have really been stalled for the past 7 months. And I think there's some expectation that the North Koreans are looking for some signal that he is ready to negotiate.
David Sanger is a New York Times White House correspondent. He spoke to us on the line from Washington. David, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, a poll featured today on the Pew Research Center website shows that roughly 3/4 of Americans surveyed say religion is a very important part of their lives. The poll also shows that Americans share a lot of values, even if they disagree on what to do about them when it comes to legislation. Well, that kind of overarching consensus is what the progressive evangelical Reverend Jim Wallis hopes will transform American politics. Wallis is author of God's Politics, Why the Right Gets It Wrong and the Left Doesn't Get It. He also edits Sojourners Magazine, and Jim Wallis joins us from a studio on the campus of Harvard University. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you, Robin. Great to be here.
And can you tell us, first of all, how would you define yourself, progressive evangelical? What's that?
Well, I'm kind of a 19th century evangelical, born in the wrong century. Mm-hmm. In the 19th century, evangelicals were on the forefront of the movement to abolish slavery. They fought for women's suffrage. They fought for child labor law reform. And, of course, in this century, the black churches where I found my spiritual home were really the foundation of the whole civil rights struggle. So linking faith and social justice is a part of that tradition, but it's been lost in the 20th century when faith got privatized. I think the great heresy of the 20th century is the privatizing of God. And the God of the Bible is deeply concerned about issues of justice and fairness and equity, compassion. So I think I want to recover that wonderful tradition, but it speaks to evangelicals, to Catholics, to mainline Protestants, to black churches, and to my friends in other traditions, all my rabbi friends and my imam friends, and all those who aren't particularly religious but care about moral and spiritual values and want to apply those to our public life.
Well, I'm going to back you up for a second. What do you mean by privatizing God in the
20th
century?
Well, all of a sudden it became, you know, just something between me and God. It became this sort of private relationship. There's a story in the book about something that happened to me when I was a 14-year-old kid. I was in Detroit having these questions about how come we live the way we did in white Detroit, and life in black Detroit seems so different from what I was hearing on the news and reading in the papers. And I began to go into the inner city, and I met the black churches. You know, the other evangelical church loved the same Jesus and read the same Bible and sang out of the same hymn book, but made it sound so much better than us. And I came back to my church with these questions and these new answers and new friends, and they told me, Christianity has nothing to do with racism. That's political, and our faith is personal. And that was the moment that I lost my childhood faith and found my home in the civil rights movement and the anti-war movements of my generation. But now I can put words around that. It's a chapter in this book. It says, God is personal, but never private. Personal, but never private.
Well, but as you know, there are those on the left who, as you've said, think this is a divide that can't be crossed, that you can have a personal God, but when you bring it into the political arena, and as you said, it's no longer private, then it's eroding that wall between church and state.
Well, I believe very deeply in the separation of church and state, but the separation of church and state does not mean the segregation of moral values and even religious language from public life. Where would we be if Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. had kept his faith to himself? He was able to bring a moral discourse to politics, but one that was inclusive and welcome and open and inviting. I say every time I speak that religion doesn't have a monopoly on morality, but a vital, vibrant religion with a social conscience is vital to helping to shape our moral discourse in politics. In the public arena, we shouldn't have a religious discussion, but a moral conversation about the moral compass, if you will, that our politics ought to have.
Yeah. Well, when you described yourself as a progressive evangelical, as opposed, some would say, to a right-wing evangelical, mm-hmm. you said that you were concerned with social justice. Mm-hmm. Well, on the right, they may say the same thing. What's the difference between you and the right?
Well, for a long time, the discussion about faith and politics has been a monologue controlled by the religious right. And this book is saying it's time for a dialogue, a serious, deeper conversation. For example, the religious right and the Republicans are comfortable with the language of religion, faith, values. And they almost claim to own it, sometimes to own God.
In fact, do you think the left has ceded the discussion of values and God to the right?
I think they have. And so when they do that, then the right gets to define the issue in their way, often a very partisan way, and values and faith become wedges to divide us and destroy us and not bridges to bring us back together again. So they narrow everything to really two questions, abortion and gay marriage, as if those are the only two moral values issues. Democrats need to recover a moral vocabulary, because fighting poverty is a moral value. Protecting the environment, God's creation, is a moral value. Whether and how we go to war and whether we tell the truth about that is a fundamental moral and religious question.
In fact, you write about it in the book, and we reported about it on Here and Now, that an example of this is the polls that were taken after the November 2nd presidential election, when polls seemed to show initially that people who cared more about moral values voted for the president. But as you write, a later poll showed that, in fact, people cared more about the war in Iraq than gay marriage, for instance. In other words, when it became specific, people cared about issues, but the Republicans seemed to be able to reframe the debate to make it look as if the left didn't have moral values by, as you say, defining what those were.
In fact, that Zogby poll asked the question directly, what's the greatest moral crisis facing America? And almost 64% of the voters in this last election said it was either the greed and materialism that's taken over the country, or poverty and economic justice. And so sometimes it feels as almost as if our faith has been stolen. How did Jesus become pro-rich, pro-war, and only pro-American? So this book is saying it's time to take back our faith, time to have a rescue operation here and recover almost sometimes a stolen faith.
But, Jim, why does Jesus have to be mentioned at all? Is it possible to have moral values, concern for the poor, concern about war, and not have a Christian faith?
Well, I don't think there's any problem with people talking about their faith as a motivator for them, as something that shapes and guides and mobilizes their conscience, their energy, their involvement. But when you get to the public square, you make a moral turn, and you talk about what is a moral discourse that's open to all of us. So you know, King invoked Isaiah and Jeremiah and Jesus as what shaped his vision of a beloved community, where everybody, those left out and left behind, had a front row seat. Everybody had a space at the table. But in that conversation, he also welcomed, you know, Rabbi Heschel from Boston, who brought his Jewish faith, and those of no faith who wanted to be a part of this great freedom movement. So everybody's welcome to bring their own faith, their own sense of moral conscience, their own values, and then we all together shape, and this book really is about not about Democrats, Republicans, but about movements. What changes history are social movements, and the best ones have a spiritual foundation.
Jim Wallis, he's author of God's Politics, Why the Right Gets It Wrong and the Left Doesn't Get It. So what would his solution be? When we come back, we'll ask about what Jim Wallis calls prophetic politics, not liberal, not conservative, prophetic. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, continuing our conversation with Jim Wallis, editor of Sojourners Magazine and the author of God's Politics, Why the Right Gets It Wrong and the Left Just Doesn't Get It. Wallis calls himself a progressive evangelical. He says he's not a fundamentalist evangelical like Jerry Falwell or Pat Robertson, because he doesn't want to legislate his own religious agenda. He just wants religious values to be a part of the conversation. His critics say that's still a slippery slope, and besides, the conversation usually only includes Christians. Reverend Wallis, let's just keep going. You say the solution is prophetic politics. You call it the fourth way, not conservative, liberal, or libertarian ideologies. It can be pro-life, pro-family, and pro-feminist at the same time. How do you do that?
Well, I think it's really making the link between personal ethics and social justice. It means focusing on the big questions and then finding some common ground on these very divisive issues. For example, I think pro-life and pro-choice people could come together in a real commitment to prevent unwanted pregnancies. Supporting low-income women, economically, which always reduces the abortion rate. Criminalizing, agonizing, desperate choice is not enough here. And so I think when Senator Clinton talks about finding common ground to help make this tragic choice less and less necessary, mm-hmm. that's language that I think people on both sides of that question could get behind, and also how to be pro-family and pro-gay civil rights at the same time. That's very possible. I had a debate, you know, with Focus on the Family, this group in Colorado Springs, James Dobson and all the rest, and I said, you know, I agree with you that family breakdown is a huge issue, and parenting is such an important task. It's the most important job in the world. I've got a six-year-old and an almost two-year-old, a T-ball coach on Friday nights. And when I say around the country that parenting in America has become a countercultural activity, all parents' heads nod up and down, yes, liberal parents, conservative parents. But, you know, I said to them, how can you blame gay and lesbian people for the breakdown of the family? And after an hour and a half, they conceded, okay, Jim, we agree that family breakdown is due much more to heterosexual dysfunction, they said, than the gay and lesbian people. But then they said, but don't expect our fundraising department to follow suit. Mm. And that, I think, is the issue here. A polarized, politicized conversation doesn't get to the real issues like supporting parents in the most important job in the world.
Well, in fact, you were talking about how not everybody fits neatly into this hard left, hard right divide.
Exactly.
And you don't fit. I mean, as critical as you are of the right, you are also pro-life, anti-choice.
No, I'm not anti-choice.
How would you phrase it?
I think we have to find the common ground that's focusing on really, really efforts to prevent unwanted pregnancies. How to make abortion rare is something we all could come together and support.
But are you for keeping it legal?
Well, I do think criminalizing this agonizing, desperate choice is not the best approach. You know, it happens every election year. We yell about abortion and nothing much happens in between to work on the abortion rate. That's, I think, what Americans are looking for, how to find solutions on these very difficult questions.
Well, you know, you have critics who say, why bring up religion at all? Kathy Pollitt writes in the Liberal Nation magazine, the more Christianity comes into politics, the more political argument becomes a matter of Christian hermeneutics or interpretation of Scripture. Everyone else gets left out, in other words, while Christians look for the phrases in the Bible that back their stand, you know, on either side of an issue. And her second criticism is, you know, why turn politics over to evangelicals, left or right, because look what Christians did when they had the chance, referring, of course, to wars in the name of religion. So what do you say to people who are worried about what you might call a transforming power of religion in politics?
Well, I think, you know, I'm against sectarian religion or turning over politics to anybody. Nobody wants that. But it's important that people be able to enter the public arena with their values, their convictions, their religion, but in the public arena, the discussion isn't about religiosity, about who prays the most or who's memorized the most Bible verses. It's about what our moral compass ought to be. All of us are concerned about a moral discussion about politics. We bring different things to that conversation, but this is an open conversation to everybody, religious or not, and that's what I think the nation's hungry for.
Why do you think, Jim Wallace, that so many politicians are so uncomfortable talking about their faith? I'm thinking of John Kerry in particular, who has a very strong faith, attends church regularly. Well, I mean, not him in particular, maybe, but why in general does that happen?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I believe John Kerry was motivated by some pretty deep moral values, but he didn't connect at that level of values with the American people. And I think it's important. People are looking for values and vision, not just policies. And I tell the Democrats to talk about values first, and policy ought to flow from that. I think people want to know why we believe what we believe, whether we're religious or not. And I think those who are people of faith, Democrats who are people of faith, shouldn't be apologetic about that. So progressive faith is possible. In fact, I would say that progressive politics are not going to win without progressive religion as a part of it.
I wonder if you could share an exchange that you had that I read about in Sojourners. It took place at, a private dinner in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and the speaker was a Republican political strategist. And you raised your hand and made a comment about, I think, what is your vision for this fourth way party. Do you remember that?
Yes, and he came in and said to us, here's how we win. We get the working class on those moral questions and family and abortion and all the rest, and then we get them to vote against their economic self-interest. He said that out loud without nuance. And the rich are with us anyway, and so that's how we win. Mm. So I raised my hand and I said, what if you had a candidate, you faced a candidate who was fairly traditional on those kind of moral values, was very pro-family, wasn't going to scapegoat gays and lesbians as if they're the ones responsible for family breakdown, and that person was populist on economics, progressive, and was against preemptive unilateral war, what would you do with that kind of candidate? What would you think? And it was a long pause, and he said, we would panic. We would panic.
Jim Wallace is founder of the Sojourners Progressive Christian Network, author of God's Politics, Why the Right Gets It Wrong and the Left Doesn't Get It. Jim, thanks.
Great to be here. Good conversation. Thank you.
And tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll, of course, review the president's State of the Union address. How much will he mention his faith? That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Many analysts have long considered mounting credit card debt to be the main culprit behind many personal bankruptcy cases, but the latest study of who files for bankruptcy in America and why points to another cause. A Harvard University report out today says that high medical bills and a loss of income after illness or injury are key factors in half of all personal bankruptcies. The study's authors say pending legislation on bankruptcy, as well as the debate about covering the uninsured, needs to be reconsidered. Here now, Martha Biebinger has more.
3 years ago, a woman who asked to be called Just Cindy had the typical worries of a middle-class single mom in Granby, but no significant financial problems. Cindy owned a modest home, was paying the bills, and had a $400 credit card balance.
I was doing quite well, actually. I was doing quite well before all these medical bills came in.
The social service agency, where Cindy helped Vietnam vets find affordable housing and drove senior citizens to appointments, cut health benefits. So when Cindy broke a leg, two ankles, and an arm in a motorcycle accident, the hospital and therapy bills quickly put her in debt. She went back to work, and then a year ago, while at work, Cindy broke the fall of an elderly client and three discs in her own neck. Now Cindy can't work and has filed for bankruptcy.
I can't lift a gallon of milk. I can't do anything, really. It's still hard. But at least I don't have collectors calling me anymore, and that's a relief. I was being taken to court constantly for medical bills, so I couldn't take it anymore.
Cindy has filed what the study's authors would consider a medical bankruptcy. Their definition is any case where illness or injury and the resulting loss of income, unpaid medical bills over $1,000, or a second mortgage taken out to pay medical expenses is a reason for filing bankruptcy. The authors surveyed close to 1,800 individuals and couples in bankruptcy courts in California, Pennsylvania, Texas, Tennessee, and Illinois in 2001. The researchers went further by checking responses against court records and conducting follow-up phone surveys with half the respondents. David Himmelstein is one of the study's authors and an associate professor of medicine at Harvard University. He says the profile of who files for bankruptcy based on medical problems was surprising.
These were not, by and large, down-and-out people. These were people Half of them were homeowners. More than half had attended college. Their occupations said these were really solidly middle-class families before financial ruin.
Unlike Cindy, three-quarters of those surveyed had health insurance at the time of illness or injury, but still couldn't keep up with bills. After they lost coverage, most either didn't qualify for or didn't have access to public health insurance. The study describes patients with heart disease, cancer, or diabetes, where mounting medical expenses, the inability to return to work, and the loss of health insurance put families who were managing to make ends meet into insurmountable debt. Study co-author and Harvard Law School professor Elizabeth Warren says even a seemingly simple medical problem can launch a downward spiral.
The vulnerability is more than just for the people who end up with a catastrophic disease. These data are the reminder that an appendectomy can turn someone's life upside down financially.
Among more than a dozen bankruptcy attorneys in the Boston area, about half cast doubt on the findings, saying that credit card debt is what brings most clients to bankruptcy court. But the study suggests much of that debt comes from charging prescriptions, lab work, or doctor's visits while debtors are out of work. The findings ring true for Maureen Thompson, director of the National Association of Consumer Bankruptcy Attorneys. She says this is one of the most in-depth looks at the causes of bankruptcy.
It can indeed be difficult to disentangle. It also can be difficult to get at that kind of information, which is the real contribution that the Harvard Law School and Harvard Medical School make to the debate here.
A debate about federal bankruptcy laws is expected to begin again in earnest later this month on Capitol Hill. A bill backed by credit card companies and other lenders would impose a means test that would make it more difficult to file for bankruptcy. Harvard professor Warren calls it a disastrous proposal that would force families to sell homes and other assets before they could file for protection. But the lenders say it is aimed at the other half of bankruptcy filers, those who use credit cards irresponsibly. The Financial Services Roundtable, a group representing 100 of the largest financial service providers, says bankruptcies cost each American consumer about $400 a year. The Roundtable's Vice President for Government Affairs is Scott Talbot.
If you have become injured and aren't working anymore but still have the ability to repay your debt, this bill would ask you to do that. If you are in the situation, as the study goes through, where you're paying all of these medical expenses, that's going to decrease your assets very quickly and you'll be still able to afford yourself bankruptcy protections.
The number of individuals or couples filing for bankruptcy has more than tripled since 1980. Healthcare spending rose sixfold during the same period. Professor Warren says the study proves the need to control healthcare costs.
This wondrous medical system that we have is generating equally wondrous bills. People today may recover physically from a serious illness, but they may never recover financially.
Warren calls the current trend towards cheaper coverage with higher deductibles and copays fake insurance.
The debate cannot simply be about how do we extend nominal health insurance to a few more people. The debate needs to be what is the real cost of getting sick and how are we going to find a way collectively to deal with that cost.
Warren's co-author, Dr. Himmelstein, is a longtime advocate for national health insurance. He says this report is more proof that employer-based insurance leaves Americans vulnerable to financial ruin.
That report from Here Now's Martha Biebinger. And this medical note, Alzheimer's, the devastating disease which causes crippling dementia and affects about 4 million Americans, is difficult to diagnose. In fact, the only definitive test available today is an autopsy. But researchers at Northwestern University say they've successfully used a test they call a biobarcode to detect proteins related to Alzheimer's in living patients. Scientists caution that the study was very small, only 30 people were involved, and more research needs to be done. But the results, published in this week's Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, show that of the 30 patients studied, the half who had Alzheimer's showed increased levels of the protein ADDL. If the test holds up in larger studies, it could lead to more research into finding a cure for the disease. Chad Merkin is a researcher at Northwestern University.
A lot of people say, why would you want to test for Alzheimer's disease if there's no real cure for it? Well, a test is a first step towards a cure. Because anybody who has experimental therapy wants to be able to monitor whether or not the patient is getting worse or getting better.
And this reminder, as always, we welcome your thoughts on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397, 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your full name and the town you're from. Still to come, what did respondents say was their number one concern in a poll in the run-up to the presidential election? The war in Iraq? The economy? No. Time. Or lack of it. We'll look at the problem of the time deficit when we come back. You're listening to Here and Now. The reporters who ask President Bush questions during White House press conferences all have to be credentialed by the White House, and the bulk of them file for legitimate news organizations. But one, it seems, is a man with no mainstream journalism experience who writes for a website that is operated by a Republican Party activist from Texas. The man's name is Jeff Gannon. His website is called Talon News. And here's the question he posed to the president last week. Mr. Bush had just been grilled about payments made by his education department to a conservative columnist in exchange for backing Bush policies. Then Jeff Gannon was called on.
Thank you. Senate Democratic leaders have painted a very bleak picture of the U.S. economy. Harry Reid was talking about soup lines, and Hillary Clinton was talking about the economy being on the verge of collapse. Yet, in the same breath, they say that Social Security is rock solid and there's no crisis there. How are you going to work? You've said you're going to reach out to these people. How are you going to work with people who seem to have divorced themselves from reality?
Well, that question caught David Brock's ear. David runs the watchdog website Media Matters for America. David, you say that question made you sit up a little.
Jeff Gannon asked a question which struck me as so extremely biased that it made me wonder, and our staff began to investigate as a result of that to what Talon News was, what its ties were to this organization called GOP USA, and the stories began to unravel from there.
And tell us, what is GOP USA and what were the ties?
Well, they're basically indistinguishable. Both are run by the same person, a fellow named Bobby Eberle, and GOP USA is not a journalistic organization, obviously, but it appears to be a group of Republican Party activists at various levels in the state of Texas.
And by the way, in the question that was asked at the president's press conference, Mr. Gannon said, for instance, that Democratic Minority Leader Harry Reid was talking about soup lines, when in fact, as you and others point out, he wasn't. That was something Rush Limbaugh said.
Yeah, right. It's we also monitor the Rush Limbaugh broadcast at MediaMatters.org, and the same day, Rush Limbaugh talked about how, and actually was bragging about how, a quote that Limbaugh had fabricated and attributed to Senator Harry Reid about soup lines had made its way into the White House press briefing. And that was the further flag, obviously, to us that there was something quite wrong here.
Well, a Washington Post columnist wrote about Jeff Gannon in March of 2004, pointing out at that time that he seemed to often ask the softball questions just when either the president or his press secretary was getting grilled. What do you make of this, David? I mean, I know you've written a letter to Press Secretary Scott McClellan asking him to have Gannon's credentials revoked. Do you think the White House has put a plant in the press conferences?
Well, I think that's a question we can't answer yet, although it seems unlikely that they haven't noticed in the White House the same pattern that others have noticed. As you mentioned, the Washington Post Online.com, and we're doing further research on this question today to establish just how useful he's been in various jams for Scott McClellan, and it would seem unlikely that Scott McClellan isn't aware of the utility of having this fellow in there. Certainly must know who he is and know that he doesn't represent a legitimate news organization. I don't know if they know all of the ties that we uncovered. But I think it's a serious question because, as I said, you know, this is on national television, and it's really a very misleading thing to have, particularly the use of fabricated quotes in a White House press briefing by somebody who isn't a journalist and really doesn't adhere to those standards.
David Brock, you've acknowledged that you once did reporting from a right-leaning slant, and you founded your website to combat right-wing agenda-driven reporting. So how important is it to you that the people asking the president questions be real reporters?
Well, we think that it's important that people who are in the White House press briefing represent
journalistic institutions rather than partisan organizations. And as you say, I mean, I do have my own partisan past as a conservative journalist, and I understand how, I and others back in the 1990s were manipulating the media for a partisan agenda. And so, you know, I think I'm particularly suited to try to root this out.
David Brock operates the watchdog group Media Matters for America. For more on his website, you can go to ours, here-now.org. David, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
Slow down. You move too fast. You got to make the morning last. Just keep
Yeah. Tell me something I don't know and make it quick. I don't have a lot of time. During the final months before the presidential election, Republican pollster Frank Luntz said the biggest concern of swing voters wasn't the war in Iraq or the economy. It was lack of time. Well, we're going to pause for a few minutes and hear some fascinating things about time, such as, did you know that Americans gave up $21 billion worth of vacation time last year? Well, Angela Rasden is senior editor for Utney Magazine. Her recent article is called Take Your Time, Why Our Busy Nation Needs to Chill Out. And she joins us now from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Angela, thank you, and thank you for taking the time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I want to get to what pollster Frank Luntz said first. That was so surprising. Lack of time, you know, rating higher than health care, the war.
Yeah, this is something I think in researching this article, I was pretty surprised by a lot of things. But among this 4% of undecided voters, the biggest issue was the fact that they didn't have free time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he said it matters to them that they don't have the time they want for their job, for their kids, for their spouses, for themselves, or for their friends. And to me, that was a real eye-opener in terms of looking at the election retrospectively.
You know, now that you've done that, by the way, do they expect their politicians to help them with time? Was there any connection there?
Well, what I thought was, especially in looking at who was elected, George Bush, to me it was more about the appearance or the aesthetic of kind of simplicity, and that he doesn't actually enact or advocate policies like a minimum wage increase that might help people have more time and work less. But he really has this kind of uncomplicated aesthetic. You know, he's the cowboy who leisurely clears brush. He's the guy you'd want to have a beer with, or, you know, you could imagine at a NASCAR event. So to me, it was just that he really had this kind of relaxed image that I think masked a lot of pretty rigid policies. Mm-hmm. But it was just the appearance, apparently, that counted.
And one woman's opinion there. That's my opinion.
Right.
But getting back to the, you know, the issue of time historically, now I want to have said, I imagine that a low-income mother washing clothing by hand and holding down a job at the factory in the Depression did not have a lot of time either. But you write that historically, most of Western culture worked so that they could have leisure time.
Well, yeah, and this is an amazing thing. You know, currently, like you noted that Americans gave up $21 billion in vacation time last year, which is just mind-boggling. We work more and vacation less than any other industrialized nation. And it seems since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, we've just gotten busier and faster. But we weren't always so lost. I talked to a professor of leisure studies at the University of Iowa, Ben Honeycutt.
And by the way, can I just stop you there? I loved that. There's a professor of leisure studies.
Yeah. I didn't know these departments existed either, but he basically said they were created because there was a time when people thought our main problem wasn't going to be how busy we were. It was going to be about how we filled up all this leisure time. You know, basically for a century prior to the 1930s, American workers lobbied for higher wages and shorter hours, and the most significant accomplishment was the 8-hour workday and the 5-day work week. And everyone thought that leisure would basically become dominant in our lives.
And you also point out that there were what are called liberation capitalists who also had that goal.
Yeah, you would think that business interests would be opposed to this, but there were these liberation capitalists, they were called in the 20s and 30s, like W.K. Kellogg of this cereal company, and Lord Leverhulme, who was one of the Lever brothers, the soap makers, and they actually thought that the coming age of leisure was a great accomplishment of capitalism, and Kellogg even put his money where his mouth was, and he instituted a six-hour workday in his Battle Creek, Michigan cereal factories in 1930. And the result, not surprisingly, is that workers spent more time with their kids and in their communities, which, you know, strengthened family and civic ties.
Which, as others in your article say, go to the point that leisure time is a family value.
Yeah, and this is something that John DeGraff said. He's the national coordinator of a current campaign called Take Back Your Time that aims to kind of correct this epidemic of overwork and overscheduling that's kind of taken over our country. But he said, you know, he said Americans talk a lot about family values these days, and especially during the election, but that they leave that one out. Time is a family value. If you have time, you obviously can get your priorities straight, and it's not just work, work, work.
And by the way, it's not just a theory. They have their lobbying Congress for legislative moves in this area.
They are, and they're a nonpartisan campaign. They aim to lobby Congress this legislative session with a multi-pronged agenda, but it includes, among other things, capping mandatory overtime, guaranteeing at least 3 weeks annual paid vacation, wouldn't that be great, mm-hmm. and 1 week paid sick leave.
Yeah, but you know, you also point out, Angela, that some of this is imposed on American workers, but Americans are also partly to blame because they want more. They've fallen for that sort of marketing trap.
They have. You know, and part of this is, of course, we have to work in order to pay the bills. But then at some point, it seems like more is never enough. And in asking Ben Honeycutt, well, you know, this great utopian experiment about leisure time in the 20s, why doesn't it exist today? He basically says, it's a complicated answer, but he says that one factor is consumerism and the birth of marketing in the 1920s, and that this new idea came along, that it was possible to convince people to buy things that they really never needed before, and that idea of scarcity, that there's never going to be enough, a lot of people agree, created our desire to have it all, and it's why we feel so busy today. Mm-hmm. He said that we're basically taught from birth that there's always more to have, more to need, and we've created a Frankenstein, a monster that requires us to work continually. So we're, Americans are absolutely to blame for part of it. It's kind of in our mindset. Busyness has become a cultural value.
Mm-hmm. In fact, you point out Americans work more on vacation less than any other industrialized country, even more than Japan, which has a special word for working too hard?
Yeah, the word is karoshi, and it roughly translates as death from overwork. And, I thought that was a really, fun and thing to come across, because I think Japan's the country we think of as really working hard and overworking their employees, and we work more than a country that actually has a word for death from overwork.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it has to do with the global competition. It has to do with our mindset. It has to do with supposed labor saving devices like computers and cell phones and Blackberries, which have instead really enslaved us, and we have to be on 24/7. And there's the expectation that we'll accomplish tasks quicker and quicker. The Ellen DeGeneres, the comedian, calls it TBS, too busy syndrome. We race to yoga, we chug Red Bull and coffee, we speed date, and we just we can't seem to slow down.
And you quote someone else saying why else it's important to slow down. It's about having time and space to know who you are in a democracy.
Well, and that's the thing. I think, in thinking of time as a family value, it's also a political value. And some people might not agree with that, but Mark Sloka wrote a really beautiful essay in Harper's Magazine on the virtues of idleness. And he basically said that idleness isn't just a psychological necessity. It constitutes as well a kind of political space, a space necessary to democracy by allowing us time to figure out who we are and what we believe, by allowing us time to consider what is unjust and what we might do about it. And I think people are so frazzled by the end of the workday, and they're thinking about the tasks and errands they have to run on Saturday and Sunday, that kind of open mental space is harder and harder to come by.
Angela Rasden is senior editor for Utney Magazine. Angela, I'd love to talk to you more about this, but I got to go.
Okay, understandable.
Her article is called Take Your Time. It's in the current issue of Utney Magazine.
You better slow down. Baby, I am moving way too fast.
Yeah, as if we're going to slow down. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again here and now.
If you want our love to last. Ah!
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.